Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, and this is episode number 92, and we're going to talk about Monty Python's Life of Brian. I laugh just saying it.
I'm just going to say, the movie that makes you laugh just saying the name.
Just saying the name, right.
That's right.
Oh, shoot. Let's see. I forgot to call up the movie, and 1979. That's the year it mm-hmm. came out. It was after, if you're a Monty Python fan, it was after the Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. After their TV show, I think at this point in time, Monty Python the group was kind of. You know, they would only come together for movies at this point. They weren't together all the time like they were during the TV show for a while.
Yeah.
And I guess we should explain that Monty Python is not a person. That is a group of six people. one American and five Englishmen. And I absolutely love everything that they've done. I've got the albums. Yeah, I've got all their albums. I don't have any of their TV show. But I've seen them.
We have some of mm-hmm. We've watched all the TV show because for a while, I guess in the 80s, maybe public TV would be showing it on a loop, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. And we bought some of the VHSs, and our kids grew up seeing some of the classic skits because, you know, we believe in the classics in our house.
Yes.
So that's definitely one of them.
Oh, that's too good. Yeah.
But I was too young at the time the movies came out. Well, not too young, I guess, 79. But I just didn't, there wasn't the kind of movie I went to see at that time. And I don't know how they weren't on my radar because everybody liked Monty Python's Flying Circus. But
yeah, and for me, the exposure was through my big brother, and the first one was Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and I remember, you know, on the TV, if you tuned it in just right, we'd get HBO or Showtime or something. I mean, I really have a clear memory. You know, my brother was the coolest because he could do this,
yeah,
and then. One time we did that, and it was the very opening scene of, you know, it was like a flashbulb memory. It was misty, and you heard.
Yeah.
And we watched the whole thing, and it was just like, oh, heaven.
Brilliant.
Yeah. We were so happy. So that was Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
I have to watch it, or I'll just start quoting lines from that, you know.
And I've got that one on DVD, and a cousin. About 5 or 6 years ago, a cousin saw that I had that and says, "Oh, I really have to watch that." So it's really popular. It was really popular at least 6 years ago amongst high school students still. So
yeah, they have that sense of irreverence, but it reaches across all these decades, I think, and it's because they were so genuinely funny. Like most comic groups on the TV show, every skit didn't work, but they were all in for all of it.
Yeah.
And when you watch the old TV shows, there are a lot of small ones in there that just never get mentioned, you know, like not the dead parrot one or those others, but there's one I can remember about somebody trying to get a form at the post office where we just sat there recently with our sides splitting because we'd forgotten all about it.
Was it the one he wanted a form for his pet fish or something?
That's
my pet fish, Eric. Yeah.
Yeah. The name? Eric.
Eric. How did you know my fish was named Eric? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Love it. Love it. Absolutely love it.
Well, great. And the Life of Brian always struck me as being the most complete of theirs. I mean, because the Life of Brian, the King Arthur one, felt apart at the end, I felt like.
Sure it did, yeah. And I agree, Life of Brian is their very best movie.
And I always felt like this one fell apart at the end until suddenly I had a bolt of lightning hit me before we watched it again this time. And I went, oh my gosh, it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just stupid. So we could talk about that later.
Sure. Okay.
I was interested. I went and looked at the Wikipedia page, which had a lot of information in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested to see that this movie, they say, urban legend possibly, but this movie came from some joke that someone made about the next movie when people were going, what are you going to do next? And Eric Idle or someone tossed off something that had to do with Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so while they were thinking about it, they thought about doing a sketch about, I have to say, it made me laugh reading it. I don't know if you know about this, that a sketch about Jesus getting ready to be crucified, but the crucifix keeps falling apart because the carpentry's so bad, so he's telling him how to fix it.
Oh, jeez.
And I'm like, so irreverent, but yet on the other hand, he needed to be crucified.
Oh, my gosh.
And since he was a carpenter, and then they said, you know, they were just tossing ideas around, and they were like, well, we could do a movie about Jesus, and then they all seemed to have a consensus of there's not really anything to grab hold of and make fun of there, which to me says something about how they were truly going for the humor and not to make a point like these days where people will think they're being funny and make fun of Christ. And they said, but what about if there was a 13th disciple named Brian? And then they eventually worked it to, quick synopsis, a baby's born next door to the stable named Brian, and he continually keeps having a kind of a parallel path, but he's no Messiah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's how I describe it to people too. Brian was born at the same time as Jesus in the stable next door.
Right.
And then they cross paths. Yeah, right. You know, they live kind of a parallel life, and Brian is mistaken for the Messiah sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's really it. And it is really funny. It is really funny.
Well, I'm assuming most people have just come across this, whether they wanted to or not. But if you haven't, from a religious viewpoint, what I always heard before I'd seen it and before I was religious at all, and this is the thing that floored my parents, who my exposure was through my parents. They never missed it. Our public TV station showed it once a week for a long time when I was younger, and they were there. They watched every one of them. They went to the movies when they came out. They crossed a picket line to go see Life of Brian from the religious people. And they came out saying, these people really need to watch this because this isn't about what they think it's about. And because it's about the stupid ways that people just grab things and incorporate them in their lives or faith without ever looking deeper. And and then, of course, a lot of other things along the way, like how to conjugate Latin properly and,
this is one of those things that, I don't understand the protests about. You know, I think that somehow it got started and people jumped on without watching it. And, if they did watch it, they've missed the point entirely. There was a backlash for it. And I think it was even banned in some countries where, you can't show this in the movie theater.
For decades.
Yeah.
Evidently.
It's surprising. You know, Jesus was shown in a very positive light. Either, if not positive, definitely neutral. At the opening, when the wise men go to the wrong stable and they're, praising Brian. And then when they go outside, they realize, the glowing stable is next door. And then you went over there and there was, and you could tell, Joseph and Mary were there and they're all radiant and all that. And it was very respectful. And then we see Jesus himself during the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
And he's giving the Sermon on the Mount. He's not being poked fun at or anything. So I thought they were respectful.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is how you do it. The point is, and all the things they're making fun of, they do in such an outrageous way that even if you're guilty of some of those things, hopefully you could laugh at it that way and maybe gradually realize it. I mean, that wasn't the reason they did it, but I look at that and go, have you seen the one where they start worshiping the sandal? Because I feel like, or they all take one sandal off, or, you know, I feel like you're doing that.
That's the exact attention. Thing. That's the thing about this movie. It's not making fun of Christ, right? It's making fun of us.
Right.
Right. The followers of religion, really. That's the object of the satire. And I mean, you watch that and you can't help, as a religious person, you know, if you watch it with an open mind and you laugh and then you look at yourself and you realize, well, so, you know, some of that does apply to me. And, you know, I think that it actually helps. That's something about what a good satire does, is it makes you look at yourself.
Well, because I have to say the Sermon on the Mount part is, to me, one of just the classic things of what do we do? There's Jesus himself. And for one thing, they're pulling back and I'm thinking, oh, right, we're going to, blessed are the cheesemakers instead of peacemakers, because they can't really hear. And I'm thinking, oh, I never thought about there's what, 5,000 people, 10,000 people, and that's only counting men, because that's how they would have counted. How would you hear all that?
Yeah.
You know what it did, Scott? It connected me immediately with the book that you had us read, Father Martin's.
Oh, yeah, Jesus, a Pilgrimage. Yeah.
Jesus, a Pilgrimage, where he talked about, they say it was here, and they're like, oh, it was a natural amphitheater for a sermon that he did from a boat. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, this is where the topography helps, I guess. But anyway, the thing that's so funny about that whole scene is they're arguing and calling each other things like big nose and mad at the rich people next to them and all this kind of thing. Here they are. It's the Sermon on the Mount. Doesn't this seem real? Yeah. You can have it right in front of you. You could be hearing it and still you just take it and do it in your own way.
That's right.
You know, like, I think I will fight with you. Thanks. Yeah. Big nose.
And the guy who knows everything, you know, well, surely he means manufacturers of any dairy product, you know.
Just the cheesemakers. Like,
I mean, we all know people like that, you know. We try not to be. I'm sure some people think we are that, but it's just like, you know, people that know everything like that just drive you insane, you know, that you seem to answer these questions whether they know or not. It's like, well, yes, yeah, just indeed, it's this and that. And you're like, or, oh, boy.
Yeah, or when it applies to someone else, blessed are the meek. Oh, that's nice. Say that a hell of a time. Like, oh, don't be meek yourself. Yeah. No, those people over there. Like, I was looking at that going, oh, this is just a classic lesson in everything.
How
do they do that? They're just so funny. Well, and the other thing I didn't really think about in this movie is, in one sense, how it really does echo a certain aspect of the 1970s, because my husband stood up. At one point, we had to pause it to feed our dogs. And my husband said, you know, I never really noticed how much this looks at the revolutionary groups of the 1970s who like to send out edicts and tell the news their proclamations on things, but they never did anything. They always just, we don't agree with this. He goes, and the media would put it in the paper and everybody get all worried and upset and then nothing would happen. And that's, you know, the Judeans people. People's Front.
Right.
Or was it the People's Front of Judea? I can't remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they were the People's Front of Judea, the one that John Cleese was in charge of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the other ones.
They hated the people. Yeah. They hated the other one.
Splitters. Little guy.
Oh, man. Oh, even when they, you know, they're there to kidnap the wife. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they meet another group there and end up getting in a fight with the other group. And isn't that, you know, that is just so brilliant. You know, because that's what we do. You know, we can fight other sects of Christianity and rather than get on with the point, right?
And I think
that's part of what the movie really is it's simply, you know, I saw, yeah, this is really worth mentioning. The after this movie came out, there was all this hullabaloo, right? Much to John Cleese and Michael Palin's credit, they went on this TV show with a bishop and Malcolm Muggeridge. And
who was a convert.
Right, right. Malcolm Muggeridge is kind of a famous apologist.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's on YouTube. I'll make sure I link to it in the show notes. But what an interesting conversation that was. And when I watched that, Cleese and Palin come off as, you know, we're the people that are tolerant and peacemaking and all this. And then the other two are really, you know, quite nasty at some points. Even Malcolm Muggeridge, which that's my first exposure. I've never seen Malcolm Muggeridge speak or anything like that. But he was I found him very unpleasant.
That's kind of why I avoided watching it. Because I thought, how embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that, you know, so John Cleese and Michael Palin are defending themselves. And in that, you know, they keep getting accused of the other two insisted that Brian was Christ and they were making fun of Christ through Brian. And Cleese said, you know, that is not what we intended to do. What we're doing is presenting kind of a view of closed systems of thought and how people take things from outside that view and then they conform it to match what they already believe. And they did it brilliantly. So, you know,
what
I don't know.
A good way to describe it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they wrote it, so they should know what they meant, whether these guys believe them or not. But they kept saying that they were disingenuous. One, I think it was the bishop, said that they were not worthy of intellectual conversation or something along that line.
Oh.
Their position was not worthy of an educated man, I think is what he said to Palin. Palin, you could tell, was getting really upset.
Yeah.
He was not, you know, you could just tell. But yeah. Cleese was annoyed, but, you know, he just kept talking.
Well, I read, again, in that Wikipedia article, they said that, and this is the thing I can't believe, this is how little respect those two gave the Monty Python group. They showed up 10 minutes late for the movie.
Mm.
So they missed all the establishment of Brian as somebody else besides Jesus.
Yeah, right.
They missed the
sermon. They mentioned in the thing the Sermon on the Mount. So they one of them saw that at least.
Okay.
But you're right. If you don't see the opening scene where you don't know who Brian is.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're missing the point of it.
Yeah, it's very disrespectful. And right. It's funny because I know of Muggeridge from my – at one point we were at an extended stay at my in-laws, and he wrote a book after he converted. I'd never heard of him, and I didn't know anything about him, but he converted after encountering Mother Teresa.
Oh, wow.
And started rethinking his entire life. And so this was his book about that. Yeah. So I just picked it up and started reading and went, huh, that's interesting. I mean, and it's while Mother Teresa was alive, so I was not surprised. But so when you said that, I was like, oh, that's such a different view. And in the Wikipedia article, they said they were really disillusioned because they all really admired him.
Huh.
They yeah. thought his, you know, he was brilliant. So they were really looking forward to it, and they had studied up on it, and so they didn't sound stupid. And I'm like, well, goal achieved, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's funny.
I don't know. They just,
these days,
they just wouldn't accept that. You know, in fact, Cleese even said, you know, well, what would it take for you to change your mind about something? You know, he's saying, you know, you're sitting there in the box.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a good point. At least, you know, the way he was coming off that one day. You know, but he clearly had an agenda and he did it. You know, I know Muggeridge only from, you know, I've told you I listened to this guy, Ravi Zacharias.
Right.
He mentions Muggeridge all the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I like that guy too. I just don't ever remember to, or listen, or sometimes I'll go over and look at his podcast list and I'm like, none of these topics are really speaking to me. So
yeah, he's really talking about atheism mostly, right. Which, you know, if that's not a subject you're interested in, then, you know, there's no really reason to listen to him.
If I'm going to be around a lot of atheists, it might be. But,
yeah, exactly.
But usually his arguments aren't the kind that I feel atheists will necessarily accept.
Well, I think that's his whole reason for existing. I think his ministry, anyway, is to try to get through to people of, you know, both atheists and people of different faith. But and he's not Catholic, right? He's Baptist, right. I think. But he was instrumental in me coming back to the church. You know, just listening to him, because you're peppered with things that make you think that the church is unreasonable all the time. You know, people laugh at it and all this stuff. And just listening to him speak about it in a way that you're like, oh, it can be spoken about that way, I think it was a really important thing for me personally.
Then what it is I'm just not his audience.
Yeah, so. And that may be, that totally may be true. Yeah. But that just opened the door. I mean, he, you know, it's not like I was converted by hearing it. But what it was it said, okay, you were thinking about this incorrectly. The fact that this cannot be is not the way to think, you know. And then you're like, okay. And from then on, it's just looking into stuff, really. Mm-hmm. You just need that door open. Right.
Being honest about it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we've kind of strayed from the movie, but I think this movie conversation may be like this because it's hard to talk about it in a coherent way other than just to say it is so funny and it skewers so many things while you still love Brian and you're even fond of all the people around him, mostly, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, because John Cleese is, well, they all, as in all Monty Python movies, which I just assume everyone has seen, but maybe not, these, what, five or six people play all the major parts.
Mm-hmm.
So in one scene, John Cleese may be a centurion, and the next scene, he's just the average crowd, part of the front part of a crowd who's listening to a prophet talk. And the next scene, he's, you know, leading the revolutionary Judean group.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you know these people, you recognize them playing different parts, which is part of the fun because they're very good at all of it. They really, exactly. Maybe it's a comics thing, you know, how comics become really great actors sometimes.
Yeah.
And
Cleese is a personal favorite, period. You know, I like almost everything he's done.
Yeah. Him and Michael Palin.
Yeah, Michael Palin. I like him too, right.
Love Michael Palin.
Yeah. Yeah, he does those travel shows. I really enjoy those.
I love those.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've watched, I think, almost all of them, except I think there's one in Brazil or something that we haven't seen. But And I think that's where I learned to personally respect him a lot.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so. John Cleese, if anyone's interested, the Fawlty Towers series, it's only 12 shows long. Every script of those 12 is just a masterpiece of comedy.
We do own those on DVD.
Yeah, so do I. They're just so good.
Get pulled out every so often.
Basil Fawlty.
Well, and this
is
just.
Did you show those during your marriage retreats?
Yeah, don't be like Mrs. Fawlty. I know.
Too funny.
Yeah, they're the don't do this example, except I'm afraid it would hit too close to home sometimes. I have no idea.
That's funny.
What's wrong with that? Funny.
So I've got two quotes here that I found. One from Terry Jones, who's one of the Pythons, and one from John Cleese that I'd really like to read. Because I think that's one of the things about this movie is how it was reacted to. Not only what it's about and everything, but how it was reacted to. So it's interesting that these two have a different view of what their own movie was.
Yes, this was enlightening to me.
Right. So I'll read the first one. This is Terry Jones. He says, well, it's not blasphemous because it accepts the Christian story. In fact, the film doesn't make sense unless you take the Christian story, but it's heretical in terms of being very critical of the church. And I think the joke of it is really to say, here is Christ saying all these wonderful things about people living together in peace and love, And then for the next 2,000 years, people are putting each other to death in his name because they can't agree about how he said it or in the order he said it. The whole thing about the sandal, it's a shoe, is like a history of the church in 3 minutes. That's Terry Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly believes that, you know, they're being heretical on purpose, and this is.
But I would say he doesn't understand the true meaning of the word heresy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And Cleese does, and in this next quote, I think we'll see that. So that's a really good point. So John Cleese says, Terry always says it's a heresy, and I've never understood this because a heresy is a teaching which is at variance with the church's teaching, and I don't know in what way we're a heresy. We are quite clearly making fun of the way people follow religion, but not of religion itself. And the whole purpose of having the lovely scene at the start when the three wise men go into the wrong stable is to say Brian is not the Christ. He just gets taken for the Messiah, and that's a very important point.
Yeah.
I love that. But it is interesting, you know, so Terry Jones may have seen it in a whole different way the whole time, where his emphasis was this, and then Cleese's emphasis was not that. And in looking up things about, you know, I read about Python all the time, you know, whenever something comes across, but, mm-hmm. you know, how they wrote the movie is basically took them years to do it. And it's basically, you know, someone comes up with something and then they wait a while to see if it sticks. And if it does, they start to kind of work around it. So you've got six people doing that until it becomes some kind of a coherent whole. So it's interesting that, you know, this scene may be Terry Jones' scene, you know, where, you know, if he wrote it or whatever, and he's got his own thought about what he's trying to do. And then the other guys have their own thoughts of what they're trying to do. But I have to agree with Cleese watching the thing as a whole. Even the sandal thing, to me, is that closed thought. I mean, that's exactly what Cleese is talking about. It's the closed thought. These guys, they believe he's the Messiah. They won't accept anything, even himself saying I'm not the Messiah. And then everything that happens, they're working hard to fit into their worldview, even when it gets ridiculous. And
I think what they're showing is how you don't have to work to put that into your worldview. You do what comes naturally and you get diverted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that picking up the sandal, they don't have to stop and work hard. They just go, oh, okay, yeah, that means something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, or the gourd.
Yeah, the gourd.
No, worship the gourd. No, the sandal. No, I'll take one shoe off. And I think what part of the brilliance of this is that Brian is so hapless in the situation. He doesn't want anybody to follow him. He knows he's not the Messiah because they could have easily made it a skewering of somebody who sets himself up as God's mouthpiece.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not aside from Jesus, and I'm not meaning to say God sets himself or Jesus set himself up that way, but you know, Jesus is the Messiah. But they could have easily said, "Oh, and here's somebody who takes that and says, ooh, I can make religious hay, so to speak, off of this." They're showing by showing them not being manipulated by anyone but themselves, you know, since they're following Brian.
Yeah.
It's kind of a natural tendency.
It is. And Brian's a good person, too.
Yeah.
That's one thing I noticed when he ended up in front of an audience at one point, which is why people started to follow him. And he was just trying to hide from some Romans. And he said, you know, basically, you know, treat other people like you want to be treated. You know, these are the things he's coming up with. The guy next to him was talking about, you know, serpents and swords and things. And he's like, hey, you know, and then the guy walking by says, who, me?
Yeah, you. Oh, well.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Well, not just you.
Yeah.
What? That was the scene I was trying to think of where they all start asking questions. And I'm like, yeah, you never get shown anything where people are having a dialogue. Well, hold on. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, goodness.
Yeah. I just also,
say, the things that people say about what Jesus is or does, besides the sandal, which is the sandal is a sign. Mm-hmm. Like the Judean People's Front, which I wrote down, so that must be their name. When they're talking about Jesus, and they say, well, what Jesus fails to appreciate is that it is the meek who are the problem, as they're leaving the Sermon on the Mount.
Oh, that is pretty funny. Yeah.
When they, I was like, that's the one interaction. And I don't think I've ever noticed that before, but I was just thinking.
That is really funny. I hadn't noticed that before. And Reg is the guy who really doesn't do anything. He's just, like you said, on the 70s groups, that's what he's doing. He's throwing out these platitudes and everything. And then when he doesn't even go with them when they go to kidnap that lady.
No, he makes sure that he's not going to go. That's he's going to stay and coordinate or whatever.
Exactly. He's in the back. And then when he was under the table, and then Brian and that girl come back after he's painted all the Romans go home all over the front of the city. He says, "What went wrong?" That was his first thing.
Yeah.
What went wrong? Shoot.
I know. Well, and in the thing of commenting on, people saying things about what Jesus said, in that sense of, when the ex-leper, which is the thing that gets me, the ex-leper following Brian trying to beg. And he's like, I had a good living, basically. And now he got nothing. And he's like, well, there's no pleasing some people, says Brian, because he doesn't give them enough money. And the ex-leper says, that's what Jesus said.
Oh, and that is so perfect. Yeah. Oh, it's so perfect. Yeah. That's just what Jesus said for her.
And it's so true really, so many fronts. And I know they didn't mean it this way because they were just doing a funny bit. But you think about just in the broader view of living, and how many times does something happen, but it's not quite good enough.
Yeah.
It's not the way we had it in mind. Oh, now we've got to do this because of that? I'd rather have been miserable.
Yeah.
Right.
You're right. It's true. It's true all the way down. It's good.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this movie worth watching, too. There's things like that. I mean, they really hit it. It just was so well done.
They just hit so many points on the head so perfectly. And, of course, usually you're not stopping to talk about it this much. So a lot of these things never really, it didn't occur to me how deeply these resonate with human nature. But that's, of course, what makes anything funny. That's why we all can get it. And it's widely popular.
Right.
We recognize it. But that's the thing I had completely forgotten about. Shoot, I can't remember his name, but it's Eric Idle in the Judean People's Front, and all I can remember is his name, Loretta, because he's basically the first transgender-type person. What's the point of fighting for his right to have babies when he can't have them, says Reg.
Yep.
And I'm just like, at the time they did that, it was so ridiculous that it was just way out there as comic humor. And now you go, I heard Spilled Milk, which is a food podcast I listen to, and the two hosts are quite amusing and they joke a lot. And sometimes it's tasteful, sometimes it isn't. But anyway, one of the most recent episodes, one of the guy comes on at the beginning, goes, okay, last time, I'm sorry, I made a very tasteless joke about transgender women, and I'd like to apologize. A reader pointed it out, and I've given money to this cause, and comedy is about this and not that. And I'm listening to this, having watched Life of Brian, going, wow, you people, we have all turned into a bunch of wimps with thin skins.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say anything mean about me.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's just face the fact. This is not... You can feel this way. I can't take that away from you, but this isn't something that, what? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I remember, I don't know, there was some filmmaker, I can't even remember all the details, but, in this movie, there was a character that was the bad guy. And the bad guy had certain tendencies. And so the tendencies of the group had to meet with the director in order to, you know, my point is, it's like, okay, if you're going to have a bad guy in a movie, you know, Hollywood has to think about it now and say, okay, well, who's an acceptable bad guy? Well, it looks like the white European guy is going to be safe.
Right.
You know what I mean? The white European heterosexual male would be okay for us to do, because we won't get any crap for that.
And terrorists, that's okay.
Yeah, so it's just like...
Nazis, terrorists again.
Right. It's frustrating.
You know, if you're German, you must get so sick of seeing Nazis always trotted out.
That's right. That's right. But right, we are ultra sensitive. One of the things that really spoke to me was there was a scene where Brian was speaking to a whole crowd of people, and he was trying to explain to them that he is not the Messiah, and they were answering him in unison. And you know, he says, you know, please listen, you know, I've got one or two things to say. And the whole crowd in unison says, tell us both of them. And then he says, this is a line. He says, look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals. And the crowd says, yes, we're all individuals. You're all different. Yes, we are all different. And then the guy says, I'm not.
The one individual.
Right. And that's one of the things, you know, when you go to a Catholic mass and you see everybody say like the creed in unison, you know, I know that turns some people off when they look at that and they're like, well, this is odd. You know, this is like, you know, us standing in lockstep and all this. But Catholicism as a whole, I think, is so big, and there's so many traditions that the individuality is prized in this church. It's celebrated. There's a lot of different traditions. There's a lot of different ways to go. There's a lot of different things to explore. It's not one thing. You know, it's all things, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's important, just to mention, because that's why I liked this scene quite a bit. You know, and not only that, but the other part of it is what he's saying. Is, you know, you need to take a critical view. You don't follow somebody because they say that you should follow me. And you shouldn't follow somebody because someone else tells you to do it either. Right. But you should think for yourself. And you should make this decision for yourself. And that's a really important thing.
Well, and when I was thinking of you talking about the creed and how it looks from the outside, like we're a bunch of sheep all together, but I was thinking, you know what the reality is internally? I'm saying that, but I'm not thinking about the fact that we're all saying it. The fact that I have to say it out loud means that I'm actually usually thinking about one part or another that strikes me during the saying of the creed. Yeah. Something usually hits me, and I'm kind of reflecting on it, believe it or not, as I go through the rest of it. And then the thing that keeps a Catholic mass, even though we're all standing and kneeling and saying responses and things, from being just this robotic unison is your internal paying attention. Because I think those big, and I haven't been to a big mega church, but I've been to smaller churches that do things like show a lot of stuff on video. And it's very, how do I say it? It's very much designed to make you emotional. And when you're emotional, I have found I'm much more a part of the crowd, whether it's watching a movie, which I like to do in a theater for that very reason, going to a church, attending a graduation. I mean, anything you're doing as a crowd where you're feeling all worked up, I then sink into the crowd much more than during a Catholic mass, where they kind of leave you alone to be an individual in the crowd because they're not appealing to your emotions. Any emotion that you get is brought to it by however you're connecting to Jesus or whatever part of the Trinity is speaking to you at that moment while you're there.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, it's funny that way.
Yeah.
It is. I hadn't really thought about it that way. But
no, I think that's great. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about it that way either, but it's true. And as you go to Mass over and over and over and over, it becomes a structure in which you work. you know, in which things mm-hmm. occur. And I think that the structure is just like the sign of the cross, how, you know, when we do the, when I do the sign of the cross, it almost puts me in a frame of mind instantly. You know, and Mass, of course, does that tenfold. But mm-hmm. There's just something about the structure of it that gives you the freedom in order to feel as an individual, which is what you just said. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
But it's really true. It's not. Yeah, it's really true.
Yeah, because the whole point of the liturgy of the Mass is designed to put you in a receptive mode to meet Christ in the Eucharist. That's why it ends so soon after the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you haven't ever been to a Catholic Mass, you know, it's the songs and the prayers and the readings and the homily and then getting everything ready. And then, you know, you have the finally have communion and all right, quick prayer, a couple of announcements, out the door, go on, because you're supposed to take that and spread it and live it. But the thing that's funny is you would think that would be the center, but it's actually the climax. It's getting to the mountain peak. And so it all just looks so ritualistic, I guess it is, but it looks so cold, but it's very alive if you come to it open.
And that's my experience too. I agree. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's kind of spoken of from the fact that when we go home, on the way home, we'll talk about the homily or the Mass or some aspect of it, like some of the songs, like, we'll go, oh, wow, I felt like I was in a little church house out in the West, the music for this one song or whatever. But we didn't know the other one felt that way because we're not being swayed around.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well put.
Thank you.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely see this movie. Yeah. If you haven't seen this movie, I really do, and I'm not saying this facetiously, but I really do think that watching this movie makes you a better religious person if you're religious. Mm-hmm. I think that it improves your life. I honestly do, because you know the satire is about you, and if you watch it with openness. And you laugh, you're laughing at yourself. Yeah. And it also it helps you to avoid some of the traps. You know, I can't say that I avoid all of the traps, but I'm just saying that this makes me think about those things. And that's a very, very good thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would definitely say this movie is the opposite of something you should avoid. I think it's something you should embrace and enjoy. Yes.
Well, the other thing I did want to mention is I had forgotten, I was watching it, I'm thinking, wow, this is more of a coherent whole than I recalled, because I hadn't seen it in a really long time. But I'd forgotten they do some stuff that is classic Monty Python, which is like, I'd forgotten the whole spaceship battle.
Oh, yeah, that was weird.
The whole Star Wars thing. Like,
what the hell are you doing? Yeah.
Jumping off a tower because it's the only way out, or he's falling off or something like that, and he gets scooped up by a spaceship in a space battle. Spaceship crash lands, he's right where he was, at the bottom of the tower.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, something for Terry Gilliam to do.
no doubt. That is so funny. Yep.
Also, it did make me think, I'd forgotten how realistic it was. And they said that one of the other things they were spoofing was the Hollywood religious epics. And it was so, it was in the little twisty streets and the old brick buildings and all this stuff with the big squares. And we were thinking, this was filmed in Africa, right, in Tunisia. And when I was looking it up, it said it was filmed in the same place as, I can't remember his first name, Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth. And Terry Jones, who directed it, said that, he said they used a lot of the same extras, evidently, because he'd be setting up a scene and the old people would come by and go, Zeffirelli didn't do it like that. So he was constantly dealing with criticism from the extras. They knew how to make a movie.
That's hilarious. That is too funny.
Oh, and one final thing. George Harrison, who was a huge Monty Python fan and was a friend of Eric Idle's. Have I mentioned this story before?
No, not that I know of.
Eric Idle was going down into, what was it? The Beatles studio. Was that Apple? Anyway, he was going down the steps because they were going to record one of those albums that you've got. And here's George Harrison coming out of it, because that's when the Beatles were still around. And Michael Palin is just, oh my gosh, it's George Harrison. And George Harrison stops and goes, oh, Michael Palin, I'm a huge fan. He said it was one of the crowning moments of his life.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they became good friends to the point where they lived near each other. And he'd go, come on out to the country house. And he goes, he and Patty were so normal. In the mornings, they'd be doing the crossword puzzle. They'd be having big dinner parties. And they'd be really worried about where to put the place cards and having the right silverware.
Nice,
and
nice.
So George Harrison financed this film because EMI backed out because they were afraid, because of the content, that it would just lose money. And George Harrison put up £3 million or enabled the financing.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, he said he wanted to see the movie. Somebody, Terry Jones or Eric Idle or someone, said the most expensive cinema ticket in history. But yeah, that's how they were able to do it. So we can thank George Harrison.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
That is a neat story.
Oh, and that finally, that song at the end,
which
they were stuck for what to do for an ending, and then Eric Idle came up with this song.
Mm-hmm. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Yes, while they're being crucified. And I always thought, wow, what a toss-off. It's like the end of the King Arthur movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just nothing. And then, like I say, recently what I realized was, I was like, oh, and I guess I'm really dense for not getting this before, but they're making fun of all those Christians where something horrible happens. And they go, oh, it's all right. Everything will be okay. Look on the bright side.
Yeah.
Which, those people drive me crazy, by the way, because when you're in the middle of being crucified, that's not what you need to hear. I'm just going to say it.
That's funny. Yeah.
I have to stop myself from doing it sometimes for that very reason.
Yeah.
You want to cheer them up.
You should feel fine about this.
Yeah.
That's not the point of Christianity.
Yeah. It'll all be better. It's fine. Mm-hmm. It's for the best. And you're just like, no, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel horrible right now. Yeah. I'll see that later.
Right. Yep. That was a tough deal.
For the clueless people besides me. Maybe I was the only one.
No, that's funny. Yeah, so you like the ending better this time around.
Well, at least made sense. I've really never been a huge fan of the song, but
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Made sense to me.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, good. Yeah, definitely go see the show.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for picking that one. I not that I needed another reason to see it, but... It's funny, when you picked it, we started to throw lines back and forth because I think we both had this thing memorized.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we could have done this podcast just started at the beginning.
Mer, what's that? A bomb? Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
We could have done it.
I love when she asks him, what star sign he is. And then he says, he's the Messiah. He's the son of God or whatever. And she says, oh, so that's Capricorn, is it? No, that's just him. Oh, otherwise there'd be a lot of them.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, too funny.
I know. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Well.
Wonderful. All right.
Well, enjoy, everyone.
Yes. Well, next up, we've got Salem's Lot by Stephen King.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a third of the way into it. Loving it.
Getting ready to start it.
What a good book. Can't wait to talk about it. And then we're going to talk later in October. We're going to talk about Super 8,
mm-hmm.
a movie that I like very much. And then we're going to talk about history, the Catholic Church through the ages, in November. History by John Vidmar. Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to all of that.
Your religious book.
Yep. It's going to be great.
Yes, I'm looking forward to all of it.
I'm looking forward to the sandal chapter of the Catholic Church through the ages.
I only have one slipper on right now, by the way, so I'm faithful.
Look to the shoe.
That's it. Went to the shoe. No, we must still remove one sandal. Oh, goodness. I love it. Gracious.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes, yes. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
In a couple weeks, you bet. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.